So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review it.
I'm gonna take this as seriously as possible, John. Yeah, I have 4 pages of notes.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
This show.
I'm getting paid to stand back here and talk to gorgeous women. We're going to talk to Pocahontas in just a moment. First of all, Brandy May, this is serious for you. The terrorists tore up your cutoffs and that started this match.
Well, as the fans saw, she really ripped my shorts to shreds. There's no way I could ever wear them again. So this is going to be the first time that I'm going to be decked out. I'm not going to lose any of my clothes, and your clothes are coming off, baby.
May I say you are absolutely gorgeous, as are you, Pocahontas. An opportunity to win $10,000.
That's right, and I feel good tonight. I know I'm going to be out there against a lot of worthy competition, but I'm going to be war dancing all over that ring, and I'm going to take home the $10,000.
David, come on out here very briefly, just a couple of seconds.
Woo, are those people ready for what they're going to see? A battle royal with all the ladies in the ring for $10,000 and the clothes are coming off. The money's going to be given away. Can't believe it.
It is going to be absolutely incredible, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, that is coming up. That is your, now let's see if I got it right. The Beverly Hills Lingerie Street Fight Battle Royal.
Very good, guys.
Did I get it right? Oh, and I'm getting paid for this. Let's get to the ring and the action.
Thank you. Chicago. Go! Are you ready for the ladies?
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and the returning Art O'Cal.
I'm sorry. This time I'm actually sorry. I'm actually sorry this time.
This was the longest pay-per-view in the history of wrestling pay-per-views. This was, I think, a 25-match show crammed into 8.5 hours.
And every match was a title match. It was Night of Champions 1988.
And Night of Meaningless Champions. We had everything from the fucking Continental Light Heavyweight title to the WCCW tag titles defended on this show. There was match after match after match into a main event with matches coming after the main event. I was so confused at times, but I made the big mistake, Arda, of waiting till the day before we recorded this to watch this show and was forced to do this in one sitting. And there was lots of getting up. There was lots of stretching. I contemplated alcohol at about 11:30 a.m. to get through this one. How did you fare through AWA Super Clash 3?
Maybe a record, 5 sittings.
Wow.
Is this a record? I don't know. 5 sittings.
Is that like a sitting for each hour of this show?
Yeah, pretty much. A sitting for each hour of this show. Oh, my God. Yeah, the booking's ridiculous. How did they have a match after the main event? That ends in a double. Like, it doesn't even have a clean finish.
Listen, the idea of two promotions coming together for a pay-per-view sounds great on paper. But this was the example of everything going wrong, each promotion wanting to protect their own guys, and the booking was absolutely horrendous on this show. And the result is AWA Super Clash 3, a dreadful show that we are going to go through match by match. The UIC Pavilion in Chicago, Illinois, which Arda informed me, in front of a capacity crowd of 1,700 people, meaning the buzz for this show must have been through the roof to see the stars of World Class and the AWA get together.
You know, shockingly enough, when you posted on Twitter, @Law Radio, that you were watching the show, Dave Lagana, @Lagana, said, I ordered that match on pay-per-view. And I asked him, do you want your money back? And he goes, nah, it wasn't as bad as AWA on ESPN. Now, I'm not that familiar. Like, I don't have ESPN Classics, so I don't get to watch AWA and ESPN. But if those shows are worse than this, then they will stay in the history books to me.
I think Dave was speaking to a lot of nostalgia, probably being a younger kid watching this on pay-per-view. Like, I think there's stuff from our childhood that we'll remember a lot more fondly than if we were to look at it with a critical eye today. I'm sure maybe this show was not so
bad. But even aesthetically,
this was horrendous. Okay, I can't imagine being a pay-per-view buyer, and this is what they give me.
Okay, you guys just did SummerSlam. Was it 88 or 89?
89.
Okay, that was what, 6 months after this show?
Yeah.
even the match quality aside, tell me that the production, look at the production. I mean, I get it, the money, the budgets, whatever, but the production value of this, fucking Maximum Pro Wrestling has done better production than this Super Clash 3.
This was, like, the rundown sheet of this show read, match, Larry Nelson, backstage interview. Sorry, match, post-fight interview with Lee Marshall, throw to Dave Nelson, match, Lee Marshall, throw to Dave Nelson, rinse and repeat for 3.5 hours. That was the rundown of this show. It was just, my God. And there was a rumor that Ray Stevens did commentary on this show.
I was just going to say, your hashtag was 5 words in 5 matches. I couldn't have said it better. At the beginning of the show,
yours
it's like,
was better.
It's like,
hot tag, color running.
Because of it, Ray Stevens all of a sudden
became Vern Gagne.
It starts with Ray Stevens, and then Vern Gagne just shows up out of nowhere, and they don't even announce that he joined the commentary team. It's just, hey, Vern Gagne is talking all of a sudden.
Suddenly, I'm like, Ray Stevens sounds a lot different. Okay, let's get into this
right,
horrendous
okay.
show.
Are you sure?
This is going to be a fun one. The worse the show, I find the more fun the review. So we'll see if that
this
theory
is
holds
be the best of all time. Let's go
here.
Let's go, buddy.
So the show starts off with Larry Nelson and Lee Marshall, two guys that you would see tons of throughout this pay-per-view. Running down the card, we have Gary Michael Capetta as our ring announcer. And the announcer...
One of the strong points of the show, may I add.
Gary Michael Capetta.
Not even as one of his best performances, but still one of the better points of this pay-per-view.
I always enjoyed Gary Michael Capetta. And we've got Lee Marshall and Ray Stevens doing commentary. That's what they told us. And we start the show off with the Rock and Roll RPMs, Tommy Lane and Mike Davis taking on, and they were teaming with Cactus Jack, taking on Mondo, Hector, and Chavo Guerrero. And I looked this up.
Chavo Senior,
Chavo Classic here. Tommy Lane, you know what his real name was?
No.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Come on.
That was his real name.
Serious?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And thus he became Tommy Lane. I made the mistake last week of associating Rock and Roll Buck Zumoff as part of this team. This was a Buck Zumoff-less pay-per-view.
Right.
Unfortunately.
So that's why I was looking forward to Buck Zumoff, but no Buck Zumoff.
No Zumoff.
That's okay.
The RPMs were our prestigious Southern Tag Team Champions, and this was an AWA versus Continental Wrestling Association match. The CWA, Jerry Jarrett's promotion. Which you can see tons of on Ultimate Classic Wrestling on the Fight Network.
Yeah.
Some doozies from down south. The Guerreros come to the ring all wearing sombreros.
Of course.
Nothing says babyface in Chicago like sombreros.
Exactly. They might as well have come out to La Cucaracha.
Yeah. This could have been the best match on the show, potentially.
Maybe.
Cactus took a back...
The Guerreros had fire, at least.
Oh, totally. I'm not saying that sarcastically. I thought the Guerreros were a great babyface trio here. Jack took a back body drop onto the cement floor, which, for those of you today that watch Mick Foley getting around very difficult, it was, even little bumps like this, that's some wear and tear.
Can we also say that Mick Foley was showing chest in this pay-per-view,
that
and he was a semblance of shape?
He was. I don't know if. He certainly didn't have any gut going. But
no.
Yeah. Some chest on display here from Mr. Jack. The big spot here was all the Guerreros come in and they do the classic pile on to the heels. A spot that I think doesn't get its due in wrestling history.
No. Agreed.
A great babyface spot. Mm-hmm. Guerreros then go crazy with a series of drop kicks. Davis then hits Tommy Lane and then gets drop kicked to the floor. Everyone goes to the floor and Chavo Classic lands a moonsault onto Davis, gets the win. I thought this was a good opener. And you know what? This match was I was even more a fan of it by the end of this show.
Yeah, and it only gets better from here, John. But another note, referee Mike Enos.
Yes, Mike Enos was an official throughout this show. Future, he would go
Blake
on to
Beverly.
Be Blake?
Yeah.
Blake Beverly.
His tag team partner, Bo, didn't do so well on the show either, did he?
Well, easy payoff for him on this night. Larry Nelson is in the back with Nina. Lisa Moretti here, the POW World Champion, to chat about the Beverly Hills Lingerie Street Fight Battle Royal. I can only imagine Vince Russo was at home watching this show with just his eyes aghast at, what a great idea. Why stick to one stipulation? This can be a lingerie match, it can be a street fight, it can be a battle royal, and you can get $10,000.
And every single interview segment before the Battle Royal would be about the Battle Royal.
The first half of this show, you got the impression this was the main event. The Beverly Hills Lingerie Street Fight Battle Royal with the tease that someone's clothes were going to get ripped off.
And Larry Nelson would incorrectly pronounce it throughout the entire show. And even him
and
Vern were laughing. They made fun of it. I know, they were like, I think you... He goes to Vern Gunning, he's like, let me get this straight. I think it's a Beverly Hills Street Fight Battle Royal. And Vern's like, you forgot the lingerie. Ha, ha, ha.
And this like, was brought to us by
that's the worst.
Well, no, Dave McLean was the worst.
Okay, fair enough.
who we would hear later on in this show. Nina, the POW World Champion, talks about wanting to win this Battle Royal so that she can get money for Christmas shopping. And Nelson, who I enjoyed Larry Nelson. This guy was just your 50-year-old backstage announcer who was so excited that he might see boobs in this match. And just telling us, remember, folks, it's live. Anything can happen.
And I don't think this was even the match that we got to see boobs, because we did see boobs in this show. In the Medusa match, she popped out in the finish.
I completely missed this.
she was putting herself back in as she was selling. We'll get to that later.
Man.
Sorry.
Art has got the keen eye. I'm glad.
That's what I'm looking for. And it's like, boobs, where? Oh, there they are. Yeah.
Oh, a Lunder Blaze. So then we go to our next title match, our first title match of the evening. Jeff Jarrett against Eric Embry for the world-class light heavyweight title. And Jarrett's defending the title. Marshall states that Jarrett could be the best light heavyweight champion right now, which would signify, yes, he's got the title. I would assume he is the best light heavyweight in the world. Ray Stevens, fantastic point here, says that, you know, light heavyweight makes them sound kind of soft, but they're not.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
This from the greatest heel of all time, perhaps.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of greatest heel of all time, no reaction at all for Jeff Jarrett. But I will say this. I don't think it was his fault, because did you feel awkward watching the entrances in this entire pay-per-view? Like, especially here.
They all looked like shit, because the music would start halfway through the post or the backstage interview. You would just hear this music blare through. And, yeah, they had problems throughout the show of just keying guys. When they were in the back, they could only do one key at once. It was just, the entrances, I thought, really dragged. There was nothing special about these.
No, that's my point, exactly. And Gary Michael Capetta would be announcing as a guy's coming to the ring. Like, it just seemed so off time. Like,
it was a real amateur production, and that really took down the enjoyment of this show for me. I mean, we can watch shitty wrestling, but this was just presented as
you
just...
and I in groves. In droves, I mean. But you know what? One thing about this match, who was it? I think it was Lee Marshall who said, oh, there's no love lost between these two. And as soon as he says that, they lock up, and that pisses me off about wrestling. If they'd hate each other, why would they lock up?
Well, on top of that, we had Eric Embry introduced, and he does all the heel shtick of, like, posing to the crowd and playing up heel. And the match starts. Jarrett works over the left arm, and then Jarrett injures his shoulder. And as he's selling it, we go into a bunch of near falls for Jarrett. And then Embry just rolls him up, gets the win, and they play up that the shoulder injury cost Jarrett this match. And then Eric Embry does the whole babyface promo after the match about how he wants to offer Jarrett a rematch and he wants to cut this interview short so he can go check on Jeff Jarrett. What? This guy made like a fucking career-altering change from heel to babyface in 3.5 minutes and a shoulder injury.
It was WrestleMania 13-esque.
This was
Bretton Austin-esque.
Yeah, this was
Eric Embry.
Yeah, the remorse over a guy popping his shoulder out of place. God damn.
Oh, man.
Anyway, we go backstage, and Larry Nelson is with the terrorist.
A.K.A. Oksana's mom.
The Syrian terrorist, who's wearing a black outfit with diamonds. They clarify she's from the East, where all those terrorists come from.
Of course.
And Nelson ends the interview by saying, I am disoriented, and I am confused, after her promo.
Thanks.
Mark me down as a second on that.
Yeah. And as interested in this battle royal, especially
if
Larry Nelson is selling
it.
I don't know. She was from GLOW, wasn't she?
Just
Gorgeous Willie's Wrestling.
Fly-by-night female worker, if you can call her that.
There were some good workers in the battle royal. It's just they didn't work well in the battle. Anyway.
Handsome Jimmy Valiant against Wayne Bloom. If you've never seen Handsome Jimmy Valiant, he is Colt Cabana minus the work rate of Colt Cabana.
Yeah.
His entrance, shockingly Like, Cabana has taken so much out of Jimmy Valiant's entrance here. It's amazing.
It's true.
Like, just, like, you can definitely see where Cabana has gotten, but everything from the way he walks to the ring, the way he would get up on the apron, shake the knees, roll up the fist. Very, very
boogie,
fun
boogie
to watch.
Man.
So, Valiant kisses Bill Apter on the way to the ring.
Who, by the way, looks extremely young, which is shocking. And it's not the last time we will see Bill Apter, which is
Bill
the best
Apter
part.
Was all over this show. This match consisted of three punches and an elbow drop where Jimmy Valiant got the win in like 26 seconds.
Yep.
And Bloom looked to be kicking out of the finish here.
He didn't look too happy after the finish either.
Why would you care? He got 26 seconds of work. Who cares?
Yeah, get your paycheck and go home.
Wayne Bloom.
And this is when Vern Gagne joined the commentary team, by the way.
This was when he made the run-in on the commentary. Right. And suddenly, Ray Stevens morphed into Vern Gagne. Nelson is backstage with Bambi and Dave McLean, who, if you've never seen Dave McLean, this guy, he was on the horrendous Women of Wrestling pay-per-view back in 2001 that we reviewed. One of the most god-awful pay-per-views in history. And this dude is like the most cheesy TV personality ever. He would stand there with like his teeth shining out, cut these lame promos. Bambi says that she has her eyes on Peggy Lee Leather. And then Nelson cuts her off because we've got time constraints here and we've got to get back to the ring. And this they were really positioning this lingerie battle royal as like the focal point of this event.
And it didn't happen last, so it happened in the middle of the show. So really, if you think about it, all this emphasis. And how many promos did they have for Lawler and Kerry Von Erich? Maybe two?
They had one from Lawler. And then an incoherent one from Von Erich, which was still better than his performance.
Yes.
Next up, we've got the Texas heavyweight title up for grabs. Iceman King Parsons versus Brickhouse Brown.
Mm-hmm. Who cares about the Texas championship in Chicago?
Who cares? Exactly. I was scared that these guys were going to get time. Thankfully, they didn't.
No. Nope.
Brown hit a spinning neck breaker and turned it into a backslide. Parsons then retreated to the floor. Parsons would come back and get the heat with a running knee. I don't want to call this a shining wizard. Brown then blocks a pile driver and fires up for the comeback. And then Brown lands on top of Parsons, thinks he won the match when it was so clear that Parsons got his foot on the rope at like 1.5 that Brown gets up and starts celebrating. Parsons picked up a book called Heel Finishes 101, grabbed some foreign object from his tights, waffled Brown in the face, and pinned him. This sucked.
Yes.
And then they showed a replay, just in case you missed the referee staring at this object hitting Brown right in the face. So, rejoice, Texas. Iceman King Parsons is still your representative.
Exactly. The only thing that stuck out for me from this match was Lee Marshall saying, who was the babyface again?
Brickhouse Brown
will show you moves all night long. And that sounds awkward coming from a man to another man.
Brickhouse Brown.
Although I think King Parsons did say Rudy Poo, so I guess he was the first guy.
Oh, he also noted he called him Outhouse Brown.
Of course.
Ooh.
Yikes.
And he said afterwards with Lee Marshall, he said he taught Brown only what he wanted him to know and then finished it off saying, Mama says it bees that way sometimes. Meaning that one day, Sid Vicious was watching this pay-per-view and thought towards his the end of his WCW run, maybe I can bring this catchphrase back. Remember when Sid started using this?
No.
Oh, God. Look it up. Sid Vicious, circa like 2000, 2001. His promos, he ended it with this line.
I stopped after I have half the brain that you do. I stopped after that.
Can we redo this? We're live, pal.
Yeah, we're live, pal.
So we then go backstage, and Nelson is with Brandy May and Pocahontas.
Of course he is. Why wouldn't he be?
Nelson starts to interview these two, and fucking Dave McLean just walks into the shot and injects himself into this promo and just starts talking about the match. Brandy then gives Larry Nelson a kiss, and midway through this, girls just want to have fun starts. And I'm just wondering, what's going on here? What is happening here? And we go to the ring, and we've got a a six-person intergender match with Wendi Richter, Derek Starfire Dukes, and Ricky Rice taking on Medusa, Paul Diamond, and Pat Tanaka. And they explain here that the AWA tag title and women's titles are on the line in this match.
Of course.
Did you catch how this match worked?
No.
I assume that whoever was pinned, they could lose their titles.
My only thought on this match was, hey, DDP's a manager. That's the only thing I thought of.
DDP was a heavily gimmicked manager here.
Oh, and of course, Medusa popping out of her shirt. From the kick, she gets hit by the kick. I'm sorry, I'm completely glossing over this match. She gets kicked for the finish, and she pops out, and as she bumps to sell, she puts her boob back into her gimmicks, flips over to be pinned. And you can see it clearly in the replay, and they show the replay, and the only shot they have is of her putting her boob back in her gimmicks.
It was the lone pop of this match.
Yes.
And Mike Enos, once again, the referee. DDP cuts a promo on Wendi Richter before the match, stating that it was a fluke that she won the women's title, and she compares it to the Minnesota Twins winning the World Series, which made a ton of sense in Chicago. Uh-huh. And then I think midway through this, realized where he was, and then said, and it was like the Chicago Bears winning the Super Bowl.
Boom.
In 85. So the heels here work over Dukes in their corner. Diamond hit a double underhook suplex. Did you notice how Medusa was also wearing the Zack Ryder one-leg tights?
Oh, of course,
well,
the weens, yeah.
She was dressed like a stripper, and I guess that at least played into that spot later on.
Stripper, monster truck driver, whatever. They're interchangeable, right?
Richter hit a very, very sloppy powerbomb onto Medusa, but Paul Diamond broke that one up. Everyone gets in the ring. Tanaka goes for a super kick, but Richter ducks, and Tanaka super kicks Medusa. And then Rice misses a drop kick to Tanaka. Tanaka still sells it. And then the guys spank Medusa after the match, after the pinfall. So all the champions keep their titles. And Ray Stevens then calls the replay that Tanaka missed Richter and hit Medusa, and then he mixed up their names while trying to describe this instant replay. So Ray Stevens made his cameo here, and he went back to just silence, which was probably for the better. And then afterwards, Medusa cut a promo about not needing a man in her corner, and this, unfortunately, was the breakup of the Diamond Exchange.
No!
Unfortunately.
Say it ain't so, John.
They kicked her to the curb. And then DDP called her a bimbo. And when asked about Medusa, DDP said, "We don't even know who she is."
Of course not.
So Medusa, everyone. A
year, and this, of course, a year before he would drive Rhythm and Blues to the ring in his pink Cadillac at WrestleMania 6.
DDP, upwards and onwards.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you'd have an even greater appreciation if you had been watching AWA at this time and then watching where he would go in WCW. Like this guy, like the most gimmicked, over-the-top manager, becoming like a legit singles babyface a decade later in WCW.
And multi-time champion. How about that? Speaking of multi-time champions.
Larry Nelson with Kerry Von Erich. Was that what you were referring to?
Yeah, yeah.
Kerry Von Erich is with his daughter Holly. I was hoping this was Lacey.
Yeah, yeah.
But instead...
Get it starting a business early.
Yes. So Kerry Von Erich says, tonight's unification match, there's one world, there's one Paris, there's one Eiffel Tower, and there's one Mona Lisa. And therefore, I guess, meaning there's got to be one world champion.
Right.
To compliment
there's only
Paris.
One Kerry Von Erich, thank God.
And he says, I'm coming fists of fire. And then he talks about how he wishes this match could be in every city in America tonight, but it's in Chicago.
But wasn't it on pay-per-view?
Kerry Von Erich was fucked on this show.
Texas,
everyone.
I wish you were here. America, I wish you were here. Weren't they?
What was the story Jerry Lawler told on the AWA DVD about this? Didn't he talk about how Kerry Von Erich before the match, he cut himself up backstage?
He did, yeah.
Probably high as
that's
a kite.
That's why at the beginning of the match, you see Jerry Lawler take his arm and hit it over the turnbuckle because he was already bleeding on his arm before the match started.
This guy was just nuts. So, up next, we've got the...
Oh, by the way, he's known as the modern-day warrior here. I just wanted to throw that
the modern-day warrior, okay. Kerry Von Erich.
Right.
Then we go to Greg Gagne against Rugged Ronnie Garvin for the International Television title.
Of course.
International Television. Did AWA have international television at this time?
Don't think it too much.
This could have been the ESPN title.
Yeah, really.
Garvin would be working WrestleMania just 3 months after this.
So yeah, I didn't think about that. Interesting.
Yeah. So not long for this company. And the title, apparently they had a match on television where it was held up by AWA president Stanley Blackburn, who brought his charisma to this show in a few segments later. Garvin starts off with a right hand, and I love this spot. Gagne was going for like the sunset flip. Garvin just punched him in the face and then sat on him for a two count. Garvin makes his comeback with punches in the corner. They announced that 5 minutes have gone by, and I don't know why, but when the match started, this was one of the few matches where they actually rung the bell at the beginning. Mm. Did you notice that? They didn't even ring the bell for half these matches. Okay. So the bell rung. And
I'm sure that the bell showed up late.
Well,
actually, they didn't have the bell at the beginning of the show.
They called the 5 minute mark at 4:44 of this match.
Oh.
These fucking lying pricks.
You know what? That's close. I thought it would have been at like the 3 minute mark.
I would have been fine with that.
Hey, for wrestling standards, 15 seconds? That's not so bad.
That's almost fair.
Exactly.
They do this spot where they land on the ropes, but neither guy goes over. Finally, Gagne gets shoved over the top rope. Garvin gets thrown into the steel post. Then Gagne immediately comes back in, and referee Marty Miller just immediately calls for the bell. This was the fastest 10 count in wrestling history, and Garvin was apparently counted out, and they state that as a result, Greg Gagne keeps the held-up television title. What?
Keeps.
This title was held up.
But he keeps it.
But he keeps it.
What, was it held up by him?
This made no sense. The television title decided on pay-per-view by countout for a title that was apparently vacant.
The best part is, most of these finishes, it feels like it was a screw job finish.
It was for most matches. How do we book ourselves out of these matches we've booked?
Yeah.
How do we keep both people happy? Because apparently everyone showed up at this pay-per-view not wanting to do a clean job.
Yes.
This was only like hour one. Gagne has an interview afterwards. He had the charisma of the same steel ring post that Garvin got thrown into.
Right.
But you must have really been pumped up for this one, Greg.
I really was. You know, since this has been held up by Stanley Blackburn, the last match we had, yeah, I've trained hard and I was ready for this one. The fans here, they like Ron Garvin. That's their prerogative. He's a good athlete. He reminds me a lot of the Chicago Bears. But, brother, tonight I was the Minnesota Vikings, and we just steamrolled Chicago.
There he is, the international television champion, Greg Gagne.
He says that Garvin blew it. He points out the crowd liking Garvin, and that's their prerogative. And he says, just in the most subtle fashion, that's fine if they want to cheer Garvin, but I just want to say that I'm from Minnesota, and the Vikings just killed the Chicago Bears. Bye. Like, ooh, I snuck in my heel line. Greg Gagne. Fuck, heel 101 here.
Wow.
Christ. Greg Gagne. I guess it was an AWA thing. Maybe a lot of Minnesota fans enjoyed this guy, but man, this guy was like, create a wrestler.
Yeah, exactly.
Greg Gagne. So.
Yeah, not exactly following closely in footsteps of Vern.
Yeah, I don't think Vern even realized his son was in this match during commentary.
Exactly. He was worried about the Beverly Hills Street Fight Lingerie Battle Royal.
Well, we confirmed that
Were we all?
Vern was backstage getting excited for this match because Larry Nelson interviews Vern, who says that the matches tonight have been sensational. And then they talk about the Battle Royal, and this is where they make fun of the title, where Nelson doesn't even know what it's called. Vern points out that it's a lingerie Battle Royal. Vern Gagne talking about a lingerie Battle Royal.
Seems odd, doesn't it? Seems like your old grandfather talking about sex. It's just unacceptable.
Very creepy.
Awkward.
About as awkward as Vern Gagne's, was it his daughter or his stepdaughter? Did you hear that story? It's like Vern Gagne's granddaughter or something became a teacher, and she's been charged with like having sex with students.
Yikes. Yeah, no, I haven't heard that
story.
It's
a weird story. Someone can look it up for us.
Send us some links, yes.
DDP walks in to this interview, says that Colonel DeBeers is going to destroy Sergeant Slaughter tonight in the boot camp match. And Gagne is so perplexed by this, says, you better not get involved in that match. Just don't get involved in that match. They preview the rest of the card. Every cliche under the sun is uttered. And then we go to highlights of the last Jerry Lawler, Kerry Von Erich match, and it ends in a double disqualification. The match then resumes, and Von Erich pins Lawler after a pile driver. And that sends us back to Jerry Lawler, who says, it's disappointing you would even bother showing this, because that was all in the past. and he cuts a promo on how every major champion was invited to this show. Only two are here tonight with himself and Kerry Von Erich. And then they break down his strategy for the match, saying, are you going to go for his leg? And Lawler says that, I know that Von Erich was in a motorcycle accident months ago, and one would think I should go for his injured ankle, but I've realized that is not the way to go, and I'm not going to give away my strategy. And I like this breakdown of his strategy for this match against... I thought Lawler was very good in this promo.
He was.
And
he was. The only shining point was his promo, really.
Well, I wanted Larry Nelson to do the follow-up of how do you feel that tonight you are literally going to make the term wrestling with a broomstick a literal term tonight.
Right.
Because that is who you are wrestling tonight, a broomstick on pills. And that takes us to the first of many main events on this show, Arda. The Beverly Hills Lingerie Street Fight Battle Royal for $10,000.
Finally.
With David McClain on commentary. And he comes out and he does the ring announcing. And he announces that the only way to be eliminated is to go over, not the top rope, go over the third rope.
Yes.
The third rope. Or your clothes could be ripped off. And they
and that counts as elimination also.
Yes.
Okay.
So you can either be thrown over the third rope or be stripped naked.
Okay.
Even though we've seen tits on this show apparently already. So then they introduce, I didn't even understand this. Like, they came out in like clumps. I thought we were getting like a tag match or something. We had Peggy Lee Leather, Luna, the Syrian Terrorist, and Lori Lynn come out. And then they introduced Malibu, Bambi, Pocahontas, Brandy May, and Nina. This felt like the extended Barbie series here that was being released by Mattel. The heels came out to Bad Medicine, and then the baby faces came out to Girls, Girls, Girls.
And then what we got selections.
Yeah, great. I was hoping that maybe they'd get charged for copyright infringement here. David McClain was on commentary to explain who these women were. My only hope during this was that the terrorist, her cardio would be shit, so we could say the line that the terrorist got blown up in this match. I love puns.
But no.
Nope.
She lasts.
You messaged me saying, the Battle Royal is so bad.
And?
It was so bad. Lynn.
Correct.
Lori Lynn was the first elimination. They explained that Peggy Lee did not want to part with her prized blue jeans.
Oh.
Pocahontas.
Why put over clothing? Do we care? Do we honestly care? Did anybody care at the time? Oh my God, not the jeans. Please, not the jeans.
Okay. This match, did anything notable happen in this match down to the finish here? We had...
No.
It came down to Brandy May and the terrorist as our final two, the babyface and the heel. The fans are chanting, take it off. And David McClain pipes in and says, they're chanting Brandy May.
Of course they are.
Now, all these eliminations came by them being thrown over the top rope. So no clothes were ripped off in this entire match. The terrorist is then sent over the top and gets kicked to the floor. No one lost their clothes in this match, which I'm not saying here as some like pervert that we had to see someone stripped down. But that was the whole build for this match, was that someone was going to lose their clothes and be shown in their lingerie. So why are we even going to tease you with this if we're not going to deliver it? Just one person gets stripped down.
Yeah, why would Vern correct Larry Nelson in saying there's lingerie too?
Like, why?
No,
did
there
we,
isn't.
I didn't understand. Why didn't we just have a Beverly Hills Street Fight Battle Royal? And then they go over the top rope. Instead of, it's like saying this match can end if one person bleeds or by pinfall. And then we do a pinfall finish.
A pinfall
why
finish.
Are you teasing fans with getting to see something when you know you're not going to deliver it?
And what? Why?
This
why,
goes for any step.
And why the Beverly Hills?
In Chicago! Fuck!
What, are they throwing Tanner at each other or something? What's the Beverly Hills connection?
This was the stupidest stipulation match I've seen this side of the reverse battle royal.
Yes, the...
So afterwards, Marshall interviews...
And by the way, I bet Vince Russo, while watching this pay-per-view...
Dude, I guarantee you Vince Russo thought this was one of the best shows in history.
Yeah. He references it when he brings up ideas in TNA Creative, right?
God damn. The terrorist is then interviewed by Lee Marshall.
By the way, Lee Marshall, voice of Tony the Tiger.
Tony the Tiger.
Yeah.
I've never gotten to interview Lee Marshall. I've always wanted to interview that guy.
Yeah, I think it'd be fun.
He's someone that's done pretty well outside of wrestling. He was the only thing that was great on this show, perhaps. The terrorist just didn't speak English. We move on. Nelson is then backstage with Peggy Lee Leather and the late Luna Vachon.
Without veins, which I thought was interesting.
But still did the crazy promo delivery. They're complaining about the last match. I sympathize with them. Mm-hmm. Peggy says that she will not have a good Christmas anymore because of losing this match.
Shit.
Medusa then walks in just randomly and puts a snake on Luna. What?
I would have much preferred them just starting to make out. Just like walk into the shot, start making out. Oh, pay-per-view saved.
They point out how the...
Where's the lingerie part? Well, at least we got to make out.
They finish this promo by saying the terrorist has now won $10,000 for Christmas shopping. What does a terrorist go out to buy for Christmas?
Yes. Yes, exactly. From Syria, might I add. Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
It's great, because maybe a terrorist can't be issued a credit card. I don't know. I have no clue.
But hey, $10,000 cash.
We go to Sergeant Slaughter, who, first off, Lee Marshall is ringside with a bunch of people. Thanks, members of the media, including Bill Apter. And Bill Apter announces that Jerry Lawler has been named the Inspirational Wrestler of 1988 for his courage to never give up in winning the WCCW title and to try and unify the world titles. This was inspirational in 1988.
Yes, it was.
Unifying
Can you
title.
Imagine if that happened today? Like, think of, like, say Night of Champions is coming up, WWE, right? They're like, and Jim Ross is like, we're going to get to the action in just a second, but first, here is Stu Sachs of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Let's talk about The Miz being number one at the PWI 500. Can you imagine that happening at a pay-per-view?
It's just so foreign, but it's like if you didn't grow up in that time period, it was like, for a lot of people, that was their source of wrestling news.
Yeah.
And PWI might as well have been fucking Time Magazine at the time for wrestling. It's amazing. And, you know, I was listening to you guys chatting about the PWI 500 this week, and it seems to me that it's like the wrestlers themselves are more into the 500 list than anything. Like, being on the PWI 500 still means a lot to wrestlers today. Like, that's a big part of their childhood, and just to be on that list, it's a big deal for them.
I don't know if Lance Storm coined it, but he was the first one I heard say it. The biggest marks in wrestling are the boys themselves.
And it's amazing when the list comes out, and you'll see wrestlers online, like, debating their listings. And I mean, one guy who's always had a big thing about his legacy and where he's slotted is Bret Hart.
Yeah.
And did you see that recent interview he did where someone asked him about how do you feel about being ranked number four on the WWE's top 50 greatest stars of all time? And Bret Hart was like, I beat Steve Austin every time we faced each other, and the list is bullshit. It's like, really? Are you that upset about WWE-made list? And you're like, it's just amazing at times where I think generally wrestlers have this kind of back against the wall mentality that, you know, we're in an industry where a lot of people shun their noses at us, and that we feel stuff like this validates us.
If they're on the list in a position they desire, it's the most important thing in the world. If they're not on the list, or if they feel they've been shunned, like you said, on the list and they should be higher, then it's the least important thing in the world. That's just how it works with wrestlers.
It just seems there's a certain...
Oh, the PWI 500 is shit. I didn't even make the list this year. Or
it's just like this unnecessary insecurity.
Yeah.
It's just it's amazing.
But I was shocked at how many, and I know we're veering away from Super, maybe that's a good
that's
thing
we
that
do.
We are. Yeah. I like how if I was a worker and I emailed PWI 500 in the correct time and I said, hey, I'm a worker, I'm based in Southern Ontario, here are some of the guys that I've worked, chances are I'm going to make the list.
Yeah, well, what is the process? If you are random independent worker in Ontario, I mean, what is the process? Is it just simply contacting PWI and bugging them and then suddenly getting your name in there?
Whenever a worker has contacted me to ask me how to do that, that's what I said. I said, go to the website, find their information, like go find the likes of Dan Murphy and Al Castillo we had on Monday, or Stu Sachs, and say, hey, here's my stuff. Here's a YouTube link of me working Christopher Daniels. Here's a link of me, you know, use guys that have been on the PWI 500 and say, this is who I've worked and whatever. Because honestly, okay, like I'll give you an example. If I were to pick one name of somebody who's not on the PWI 500 right now, and you've been to a lot of indie shows in Ontario,
sure.
Brent B., for example.
Definitely. He's not even on the list?
He's not on the list.
But
I'll tell you why. Because he's not an email guy.
Yeah.
He is not a contact information guy. He's not computer savvy. And that's sad to me because he deserves to be on the list, in my opinion.
That's what I look at, something like the PWI 500. Like, we're not really looking at a list. To me, it's more just, for workers, it's a great marketing opportunity to get your name out there.
Sure.
And suddenly people, that is still, even if you have migrated over from the magazines, the PWI 500 is a list that people typically still just look at. It's a nostalgia thing. It's just cool to see. Do you remember that year that one guy, Joe Rules, was number 500, and he made that his gimmick, that he was number 500 on the PWI 500, and it was like, I remember seeing him talk about how he was so happy he was 500 instead of 499, because everyone remembers the 500 guy as much as the number one
guy. Mr. Irrelevant, right? I guess the NFL draft order, they have Mr. Irrelevant, so number 500 is Mr. Irrelevant.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
There's one, I know one worker, I won't say his name, told me, okay, well, I'm in the 200s this year. Next year, I plan to jump this many spots. Next year, I plan to jump even more. And I hope to be, you know, in the 150, 175 range in 3-4 years. So, like, people are thinking in the future about their listing in the PWI 500.
What is the mandate for, like, okay, you jump 100 spots. What does that mean? Is this like,
you're 100 people better? I don't know.
do you send in your win-loss record?
Well, you know what, though? To play devil's advocate, when I saw Tyson Dukes at 120, I was proud of him.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you know what? He's higher on the list than MVP. He's higher on the list than David Hart Smith. He's higher on the list than a lot of guys that were signed this year. And I agree with you. It doesn't necessarily matter that much. But at the same time, when I see that, I'm like, of course he fucking deserves to be 120. He's one of the best workers I know.
When did you start checking out a PWI?
A long time ago, man.
I remember when I found that, and it was like, I would go every month and get PWI, and I would get Inside Wrestling.
Yep.
And it was like, you read those, what was it, the article where it was like phone call between wrestlers and stuff. And it was just the fact that they would openly talk about both companies. And you were like, wow, this is different from WWF magazine.
Holy
like, as an
shit.
11-year-old kid, man, those magazines were phenomenal at that time period.
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
And it's something that it's like, if you're an 11-year-old kid now, do you really have that outlet? Are kids going and getting PWI now? You barely...
They have websites.
It's just...
They have liveaudiowrestling.com. Why do they need PWI? They have Fight Network Wrestling News. What do they need PWI for?
11-year-old kid who goes in. It's like... What's a wellness policy and why is Sin Cara gone?
No, why does he look different? I don't get it.
I almost like, I don't know. I almost, if I were to meet like a 10-year-old kid, it was like, I would almost, you know, enjoy wrestling. It's like, I don't like having to, you know, pop a little kid's dream or something, you know, to find out all this shit that goes on behind the scenes and stuff we hear about on a daily basis. It's like, if you're a 10-year-old, imagine hearing all this stuff about wrestlers, and it's you know, it's such a different kind of fan that I think is coming up today that's on the internet and reading about all this legit stuff or watching Matt Hardy online. It's like, what's going on here, man?
How do you feel about that? I'm sad.
It's depressing, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I've, you know, there's a lot of Hardy supporters out there, but it was like, did you see that Q&A Rebby Sky just did today?
No.
She was on Twitter and she was just taking questions from people, and she was talking about how this has been like the worst week of her life. Every day has been worse than the last. If it wasn't for me, Matt would probably be dead by now. She's sick and tired of all these enablers around. It's just like kind of shining a light to kind of call bullshit on whatever you're hearing from Matt about. It's just, man, like, I understand they're trying to take this whole stuff and make it into some online shoot angle shit, but it's like, man, I think both these guys need some kind of rehabilitation at this point. Like, these two guys should not be on the road, and it's just, we're watching two people, specifically Matt right now, it seems like, are falling apart, and you're watching this, and it's just so weird, you know
and
what I mean?
The problem is kind of like the Jersey Shore phenomenon. I guess people are just drawn to it. They want to see the train wreck. They want to continue to consume the train wreck.
Like, look at even Shane Helms. I saw him post that thing about, you know, he's my friend and I support him, but it doesn't mean I agree with what he's doing and that I'm not upset with what he's doing. It's like, these are his close friends here, you know,
his best
what I mean?
buddy.
And it's like, fuck, man, at some point you just gotta, like, I'm tired of, like, certain people that are just saying, you know, leave these guys alone. And, like, I'm not saying trash these people, but at the same time, it's like, don't just blindly support these people that are clearly going through serious issues right now that probably a lot of people can't relate to. Like, he's got a sickness.
He does.
That's what it comes down to. And it's like now today you have social media where you can watch it every single day.
Not only that, but maybe Twitter is the enabler.
Totally. Like, 10 years ago, you didn't have this audience at your fingertips that are just waiting to hear from you and see something. And it's just like going completely off the deep end right now. You're like, what do you think about Jeff coming back? Like, is that – how do you make that decision?
But if I'm a company and I have every indication to believe that this person is okay or their issues are behind them, and if I've been proven by doctors or whatever, then – I can't say anything. But in Jeff's case, I think that obviously there's nothing. You know what I mean? Like, there's something there.
Like, I mean, it's not...
Obviously.
It's not like Destination X was a one-night incident, you know?
No.
You've heard so many stories of this guy having problems. And it's like, I don't know. I just feel that...
At what point do you say you need to sort your problems? But at what point do you say, okay, you've been healed? Like, what are we waiting for? Are we waiting for... Well, what kind of proof are we waiting for from Jeff and Matt Hardy? Are we waiting for them to post a message to say, hey, guys, just so you know, I've gone through rehab. I'm back. I'm okay now. I've lost 20 pounds. I've tanned. I look better. And I haven't touched a drug in 6 months, so I'm good to work now. I mean, what are we waiting for? Like, what can we say?
I'm just – I'm looking that Jeff Hardy comes back. How is there not going to be an incident in the next 6 months? Like, I give it a 10% chance this guy comes back and there's no, and then it's, you know, TNA, you guys have given this guy chance after chance. He refuses, this guy's been refusing to go to rehab since he was fired from the WWF in 2003. There's been issues. You know what I mean? Like, how many times do we have to watch, like, the road is not the place to be trying to figure out shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. So.
Back to AWA Super Clash.
Can we get back to Colonel DeBeers, please?
I needed an intermission from Super Clash.
For crying out loud,
we needed to talk about drug addiction to get away from
the
show.
That's what we have now after watching this show.
All right, where were we here? Sergeant Slaughter is going to beat Colonel DeBeers tonight in a boot camp match. And then from there, we go to the boot camp match. Sergeant Slaughter and Colonel DeBeers, who's accompanied by Diamond Dallas Page.
Which makes perfect sense, right? The terrorist, or I mean the militant being accompanied to the ring by the flamboyant manager. That makes a lot of sense.
Colonel DeBeers had a crazy gimmick for like the 80s. You know what I mean? Like just wouldn't wrestle black people and like incredible. Like this was going on in the 80s. Like that shows you pro wrestling in the 80s, man. It was, you watch some of these gimmicks. It's like, wow.
Pretty risque.
These guys would get fucking raked over the coals if this was presented today, man. They fight to the floor. DeBeers attacks him with, what do you call these steel things that hold up those, they didn't have barricades here at this show. They had the fucking movie theater fucking.
Yeah. The rope.
Yes. So he beats him with one of these steel, whatever it's called. Then he worked in, his army helmet into this match. And
Thank
we
God.
Saw the battering ram where he ran into Slaughter. Slaughter then takes the helmet, delivers these light headbutts. The final one sends DeBeers into a huge back bump that he takes, then applies the Cobra Clutch. DDP gets onto the apron, and then he starts waving in somebody, and it's Sheik Adnan Al-Casey who comes into the ring, everyone. Slaughter wins the match before Casey makes the run-in. Casey was too slow
he
here.
He was too slow. It was Papa Shango at WrestleMania 8. This is too slow. He's just too slow. He can make it.
So,
but behind him, oh boy.
Oh, then in this got great. The Iron Sheik shows up to run in and help the heels. And they beat down Slaughter, who had already won the match. And then the Guerreros run down to make the save. So we've got a Mexico-Iranian feud.
I was just
going to
say, since when did Mexico have any sort of beef with Iran? And by the way, Iron Sheik's massive Iran t-shirt, please sell that.
Oh, a great seller. Did you notice the connection here? We had Slaughter, General Adnan, and Colonel Mustafa in the ring together some 3 years before they would be the that trio in the WWF,
yes.
The match made in hell.
Yep. Yeah.
I remember as a kid watching that SummerSlam show for the first time. I loved those three together.
They were
General
awesome.
General Adnan cutting these insane promos, and didn't know what language he was speaking, and Slaughter was like the scariest heel imaginable.
But then after SummerSlam, I want my country back. And he got his country back. Good for you.
Forgiveness, everyone. So Sergeant Slaughter here.
Hey, you know, to be fair though, he main evented a WrestleMania.
Hey, good for him, man.
He did.
That was and you want to talk about like controversial angles, man. They were doing some crazy shit going into that WrestleMania, like burning the
Hulk.
The Hulk Hogan thing.
Speaking about that, I spoke to Slaughter once, and apparently he wanted to burn the American flag.
Yeah.
And can you imagine if he had done that? Oh,
they,
man.
I remember the. Did you go to that Mayhem show that was here at the ACC, the WCW
No,
pay-per-view?
I didn't. I didn't go to that.
I remember
the WWE was in town the night before, though.
That's right. That's right. And wasn't it a deal where the WWF tried to go late on their? I can't remember what it was. Anyway, I was at that show, and it was later the Revolution. That was the team, and they were planning that night because they were in Canada and could get away with it. They were going to burn the American flag on pay-per-view that night. And they basically got the word from, like, high up in Turner was like, you guys burn that American flag, you can forget having a television show. Like, that was serious business, man, burning a flag. Burning an American flag.
Let me ask you a question. Because Shawn Michaels, like, put the Canadian flag in his nose and he kind of spit on it, he humped on it and stuff. If they burn the Canadian flag, would we be pissed off as much as if the American flag was burned?
U.S., it's like such a different breed of patriot.
Yeah,
that I
right?
think it would cause so much outrage. Whereas in Canada, I can't imagine that because of like the precedent right there. When Shawn Michaels did that, was there any real outrage? You know what I mean?
No, it was just like typical heel spot.
I was like, I don't know, like burn it. I don't know. I'm not an American, so I can't really say. But to me, it's like, I don't know, burning a Canadian
Maybe
flag.
If,
would I really?
I wouldn't care. I'd be like, yeah, whatever. It's heat.
Like, it's.
I want to know though if there's any Americans listening to this that
we're gonna get fucking hate mail.
I just want to know if there's any sort of like to the point where they would feel offended personally that they would either A, stop watching the show, or B, retaliate in some way.
See, I've always been of the belief that, you know, you can present tasteless angles that are just tasteless for the sake of being tasteless. But I think if it is a strong story, I mean, you know, if you put this under the context of watching like a serial drama or something, you know, if it fits the story or something like that, I mean, there shouldn't be anything that necessarily is taboo. You know what I mean?
I agree.
If it's presented and it's telling a story and there's a heel and there's a baby face, I don't know. I just feel that it's, you know, I don't get too outraged over, you know, content and stuff like that, but some do. And I'm sure we'll get some feedback from people. All right. Boot camp match over. Bill Apter presents the Inspirational Award to Jerry Lawler. He accepts, says he's going to unify the titles tonight, and then will be the Wrestler of the Year for PWI in 1989.
And also says, I won't say I deserve it.
But I deserve it.
Yep. Now, is he a babyface or a heel in saying that?
Well, you know what? He seemed to be the heel going into this match against the guy representing Texas, but my God, how you could not love Jerry Lawler on this show? Like, he tried to single-handedly save this show for me.
He did.
Then we've got the Samoan SWAT team against Michael P.S. Hayes and Steve Cox for the world-class tag titles. Who is Steve Cox? You ever heard of this guy?
He is not Buddy Roberts. Let's just put it that way.
I
will say I liked the work of the Samoan SWAT team, soon to be called
young,
the Head Shrinkers.
A young Fatu and Samu.
I like their work. They did good on this pay-per-view.
I liked the Samoan SWAT team here. They were accompanied by Buddy Roberts, who had turned on his longtime Freebird partner, Michael Hayes. And he was accompanying the Samoan SWAT team wearing Jägermeister shirts.
And coming
did
out to
the Samoans have sponsors here?
Apparently, and they came out to Don't Worry, Be Happy. Come on. Come on. What's
Don't Worry,
that?
Be
What's up
happy.
With that? What is up with that? I don't
guess
understand.
That was the big song in December of 88. Steve Cox here. I don't want to be too critical here, Arda, but you're one to always kind of look at the little things.
Yeah.
And here he was wearing like almost identical tights to the heels. Did you notice this?
I hate that, yes.
Michael Hayes wearing distinct like baby blue tights. And Cox here wearing like the same kind of weird tights as the Samoans.
I always mention that. I mean, this is not new. If you're working somebody, look at what they're wearing. Remember Starrcade 83, Valentine and Roddy Piper in yes. the in the dog collar match? Same exact gimmicks.
Yeah.
If I'm sitting in the back row, it's difficult for me to decipher who's who.
It's just, you know, I always, that's my pet peeve when you have guys that are wearing, you don't get it as much now, but when you had like the single color, you know, spandex tights and you'd have two guys wearing the same thing. It's like, why? This is silly. So we see Samu goes for a punch in the corner. This was weird. Samu goes for the punch. Cox doesn't duck, so Samu stops. Then Cox ducks, and Samu finishes with the punch and hits Fatu.
Of
Horrendous
course.
Spot. Fatu eventually guillotines Cox on the top rope. We get the hot tag to Michael Hayes, who's in with Fatu. Takes out both with a back body drop and then a lariat. All four get into the ring. We see a tope to the floor by Steve Cox with Ray Stevens selling it with, oh!
Ooh,
what? It was like Bill Goldberg calling the Brock Lesnar Minsu Kim match.
Good analogy. I like that.
Hayes gets...
And another right hand. Oh. And another. Oh. And another. It was like, that was like half the match. And another.
Hayes then has Fatu for the visionary. The ref is distracted, and Buddy Roberts comes from behind, hits Michael Hayes with the dreaded wallet, and then puts Fatu on top, the Samoan SWAT team, who had to be given the abbreviation SST because Samoan SWAT team is just too much to pronounce.
Sure.
They get the win, and Michael Hayes sells this attack via Buddy Roberts' wallet for like 10 minutes. He's lying paralyzed in the ring. And they try to make sense of this.
What was in that wallet?
He hit him with the wallet, but it was attached to a chain.
Of course.
What was this?
Dastardly.
This was ridiculous.
Michael Hayes, man, selling machine. To a wallet.
It was like
that guy that got hit by the, I don't even know who it was. Remember when he got hit by a popcorn bag and he sold it, like, jumping over the top rope?
This like resembled a guy that found out he was doing the job and he was like, okay, and I'm going to milk this finish so that I have the sympathy by the end of this segment and no one remembers me losing by the end of it.
Yep.
This was like an old school worker mentality here.
Get your shit in.
Next up, we've got Nelson backstage with the Iron Sheik and Adnan Al-Casey. I don't know what they said in this promo, but it was Sheiky being Sheiky and General Adnan being Adnan Al-Casey.
Yes.
Wow, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Now, Sergeant Slaughter, I have told you, I have a big surprise for you. For you and the AWA and the rest of the wrestlers in the United States of America. And the surprise is a proven, and we not finish with you. We're going to chase you every place, everywhere, until we're done with you. And this is the surprise. Chitori Agha Khuba.
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah.
Sheikh Adnan Al-Ghaisi.
Yes.
Assalamu alaikum. Every intelligent American, Mr. Nelson, know about the Iron Sheik and Soldier Slaughter. No. Mr. Sultan Slaughter, I know that's your country. You have a lot of support. But remember, our support is Allah, not Ali, Muhammad. Sultan Slaughter, all over the America, all over
all
the
right,
world.
All right, that's enough of this raining and raining, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get back to the arena.
The Iron Sheik and Adnan Al-Casey.
Another match. Manny Fernandez and Wahoo McDaniel in an Indian strap match, which the politically correct term now would be Native American strap match.
Correct. Which Wahoo McDaniel has never lost.
That is true.
And Manny Fernandez is one of your top heels on this show.
The Raging Bull. Gary Capetta introduces us to IWGP Heavyweight Champion Tatsumi Fujinami, and Fernandez cuts a promo on him and then shoves Fujinami. This would lead to the post-match. They have to drag their opponent to all four corners. I don't think I've ever seen a WWF strap match that has not ended with the exact same finish of the babyface being dragged to the four corners. The heel would hit the corner, then the babyface would hit it from behind, and then when they get to the fourth corner, the babyface would overpower the heel. I've seen that in just about every WWF strap match.
Yeah. Except for JBL and Eddie Guerrero. That's the only one that I can think of where JBL, he pushed him
right?
to the corner and he hits the buckle first. That was a very heel finish. That was actually a very good way for JBL to win the championship.
I just
put
remember
that, over.
That being just this bloodbath
yeah.
from Eddie Guerrero, like just a sick blade job. McDaniel, speaking of blood, was bleeding from the forehead early on as Fernandez starts to drag him. This leads to a chop fest between both. McDaniel's chops are just disgusting.
And may I add that Steger Lee Marshall said he peeled him like a tomato.
Peeled him like a tomato.
Yeah.
Fernandez is then bleeding. Starts dragging McDaniel. He hits three turnbuckles, but then Wahoo stops him with a low blow. We see a knee off the second turnbuckle to Wahoo. Fernandez is then touching the pads. And then for whatever reason, he climbs to the top rope, gets pulled off of the top. And then Wahoo powers to three turnbuckles. And on the final one, Fernandez kicks Wahoo into the corner and he wins. This was just, to me, what a shitty payoff. They built this up as this big feud, and they made it crystal clear that this feud was going to continue. And they fight afterwards. The referee gets tossed to the floor. Fujinami makes the save for Wahoo McDaniel. And then McDaniel cuts a promo afterwards saying that, "I've never lost a strap match. This feud is not over. And this might have to end behind the building or with a gun because I won't be happy till he's dead." And Marshall then says, "Well, it doesn't get any more clear than that."
It
so
doesn't.
They were building up to a gun match.
And how, exactly. What do you go? Where do you
what,
go
what
from
did I
there?
Pay for on this pay-per-view?
Like, there's a joke in wrestling. Like, you've probably heard it too. Like, where somebody like all so you have so many false finishes in a match where you're like, what do you need to do to beat this guy? Shoot him in the face? Like, that just reminded me of that. In this, it's like, what are you gonna do? Have a shotgun match?
I just thought with all these shitty finishes, it's like we get the babyface wins by some fluke here where the heel just kicks him and he happens to fall into the turnbuckle where he wins. And then they make it clear that nothing has been resolved. What did I pay to see here? I just, this drives me crazy on this particular show where it seemed that nothing was resolved. So then we go more Larry Nelson. He's with Vern Gagne and Stanley Blackburn. They talk about how violent the last match was. And they talk about, yeah, that was too violent. It should have been stopped earlier. And Vern talks about the main event. He talks about the exact same points he made an hour ago when he was asked the exact same question. They call it the greatest night in wrestling history.
What, you don't agree?
The greatest night in wrestling history. And Gagne thanks all the other promoters, including Jerry Jarrett, Don Owen, and Tim Woods. Marshall says there's two more matches. And I wrote down, stupidly, Marshall, there's only one more match because Jerry Lawler and Kerry Von Erich is up next. No, it was stupid John Pollock. You were making logical sense of how this show would be booked. So,
by the way, the last match on the card being a match that has not been talked
not
about once.
Mentioned once. Fuck.
But still got the most pop in the entire show somehow. Which is shocking to me.
I can't believe, like, this. I would not have lasted sitting in this arena for this long for this show. We've got Jerry Lawler and Kerry Von Erich. Our guest ring announcer is Al Lehner from WGN Radio.
Yep.
Awesome yep. get.
And Lawler, can I just say before we start, this was the reason I chose this pay-per-view to do review away. This is the reason. I wanted to see this match in its entirety, and
this was the... Speaking of the modern-day warrior, this was the modern-day Sting-Jeff Hardy match. If Sting and Jeff Hardy at Destination X had to have gone 18 minutes.
Yes.
Because Kerry Von Erich, I don't know what the state was. We always heard stories of this guy being a wreck backstage. He had tons of issues. He did not seem to be coherent at all during this match. And I was blown away by Jerry Lawler trying to get a match out of this guy here because he seemed lost. Von Erich was all over the place. We see his right arm is cut up. They explain it right away in the first minute or so that Lawler has opened up his arm, which is logical spot to do to have a guy cut up. So they had to explain this guy just doing whatever it did backstage. And a great companion for this is the WWE's AWA DVD release they had a few years ago. I tried to find it online yesterday to watch. Not easy to find online, so you got to buy it. They did a test of strength spot. This was all Lawler selling here because that was the only way this match was going to work. Von Erich doing crazy offense. We saw Von Erich go to the floor on the apron. He goes for a slingshot splash over the top. His legs buckle on the top rope, and he just falls straight down, and Lawler just puts his knees up. Was probably so upset during this match. Lawler hits the pile driver. Von Erich no-sells it and hits him with the discus punch. Lawler kicks out. And then we got the first of like 5,000 iron claw attempts by Kerry Von Erich. Mm-hmm. Von Erich then went for a pile driver, but the referee was out. He comes to, only gets a two count. Then Lawler hits the first of two flying fists off the second rope. Von Erich was all bloody at this point, and the referee kept checking on Von Erich's eye to see if he could continue. Von Erich then put the claw onto the stomach of Jerry Lawler.
Sure did.
This looked like the least convincing submission I've ever seen in my life. The iron claw to the stomach.
Of course.
With like this lazy grip. And the announcers even point out that this would be much more effective on Lawler's face, which was what Von Erich switched to. Lawler then avoided an Irish whip, and Von Erich runs into the steel post into the corner, and he keeps attacking Von Erich's face. Lawler attacks Von Erich with something inside of his tights, and world-class matchmaker Frank Dussek is outraged here as Lawler once again hits him with the referee distracted. Lawler's attacking him on his feet. He continues to check on the eye, and then each knock the other out with a punch. Von Erich applies the claw when he recovers, and Marty Miller then, while the iron claw is applied, calls for the bell. Everyone thinks Von Erich's won, but it's the dusty finish, where instead he has ended the match because of excessive blood loss over the eye of Kerry Von Erich, and therefore Jerry Lawler wins both titles by ref stoppage.
Yes. Now, I watched the end of this match with Jimmy Corderas, and he was quick to point out that in that situation, because Lawler's shoulders were on the mat, there should have been a count first before the stoppage. So it was very interesting that the referee saw that and said, wait, I got to tend to the blood first before the pin.
So
it's very interesting.
This match just to me reeked of, we have no plausible finish, so let's just overbook the hell out of this finish. To me, it was just like, you obviously want to protect both guys, but at the same time, it just came across to me like a very flat finish. Nothing was resolved, and that was the overarching theme of this show. Nothing was resolved. And it was just like, why do I want to see a co-promoted show when these are going to be all of the obstacles I, as the fan, have to put up with?
The only thing that was resolved for me was whether or not Kerry Von Erich, in fact, did have a prosthetic foot. And this is another Corderas find. You can see in his feet that one foot is thicker than the other.
Yeah,
and that's
why
he wore the tassels in the WWE so he could hide it.
It's actually incredible that this guy could work matches with like an unknown, with no foot. Like that's
and a, while extremely
and
inebriated. Like,
guys,
yeah, exactly.
You know?
And while in the state that we may think he was in this match.
Like, I thought Lawler did the greatest job he possibly could in this match with a very...
And that being said, it was still a bad match.
This was
he
bad.
Did the best he could. Like, if anyone could have done it, I mean, who would have been better to do it? Maybe Michaels? I don't know. But, like still.
When you hear the term working with a broomstick, that's what Lawler was dealing with in this match. And it was a horrendous performance by Kerry Von Erich. And this was, of course, afterwards. Lawler never defended the AWA title. He claims to this day he's never gotten his payout for this pay-per-view.
I'd like to know how many people did get a payout for this pay-per-view. Look at the amount of talent on this card. Forget about the matches, but think of the talent, and then think of how many people were in the arena.
Is this the infamous show that Chavo Sr. to this day is upset he never got a payoff over? Remember
I'm
that?
I'm sure.
He raised this big stink to Vern Gagne a few years ago at the Cauliflower Alley Club about not getting some AWA payoff. I wonder if it was this
probably
show.
This one.
Who knows?
Who got paid on? That's what I want to know. I'd love to know who got paid on this show.
Brandy May.
Yeah, the terrorist probably got her $10,000. That's where all the payoffs went. The boys got to find the terrorist to get her
payoff. You don't screw around with a terrorist. So
good night, everyone.
No! No, Arda, there's another match! There's another fucking match! It's like, what?
Which has not been mentioned still.
Oh.
But we got the biggest pop of the night, too. That's the worst part.
We don't even get any promos, nothing to build up. It's just another match on top of this.
But the Rock and Roll Express still got the biggest pop of the night. Right.
This was just unbelievable. So we move on to the stud stable. The stud stable, backed by popular demand from last week. Jimmy Golden and Robert Fuller against Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, the Rock and Roll Express. Crowd was dead by this point, by these guys, by the start of this match. Marshall calls this the most exciting night in the history of wrestling. I beg to differ. The stud stable is accompanied by Sylvia, who's got a kendo stick in the corner of the stud stable. We saw a big bear hug spot with Golden to Gibson, and they built up to the Ricky Morton hot tag. Golden then tosses Gibson over the top rope to the floor. Sylvia attacks him with a kendo stick. Morton then makes the hot tag. The Express double team Golden with a double drop kick, but Fuller is back in. Fuller then tosses him into the steel post on the floor, and the referee just calls for the bell. Match is thrown out. We finish the night with a double disqualification and no winner as they fight and go to the back. Lee Marshall does an interview. Morton and Gibson say they want to be five-time tag champs. Then we go to Larry Nelson with the stud stable. Golden says he's in great shape. Don't make fun of my cardio. And they're not impressed with the baby faces Rock and Roll. I don't even know what this match was, Arda, because I was so out of this show by this point. I was so mentally drained that I just wanted this match to be over with.
Yeah.
And that was it.
That's it. Sorry. Then Lee Marshall interviews Vern Gagne. Hold on.
We have to wrap up this gem of a show.
The line of the night, of course, was Lee Marshall, once again, one of the greatest nights ever in professional wrestling, Vern Gagne saying, "It was a night."
It was a night.
That was the line of the night. It was.
And Vern saying, "I don't know how the Iron Sheik got into the arena, even though we gave him a fucking backstage segment."
Of course, he doesn't know. He allowed him to speak once he got in, though.
Oh, that was the end of Super Clash 3. I give this show a 0 out of 10.
I can't argue.
I didn't enjoy the show
at all. I give myself a 0 out of 10 for choosing this pay-per-view. Yes. And I'm glad that people listening to this will now never have to watch it if they haven't.
I hope we saved everybody 4,000 hours of their life. That was Super Clash 3. 72 minutes to get through that.
My crumpling my papers.
Woo! Super Clash. Let's get into everyone's feedback, Arda, because it'll be more enjoyable.
All right.
Jack Pisco, he's got a question for Arda. He wants to know, when dealing with outside talent from companies such as TNA and Ring of Honor, what's the experience like when trying to book and promote your wrestling shows, dealing with other companies?
ROH guys, you can deal with directly. There's no company involvement, really, just because I guess they consider themselves the top of the indies. TNA, a lot of times, there'll be contracts where you have to go through TNA, so they may put a premium on a regular fee. But usually it's pretty pleasant. I mean, TNA, dealing with them to book talent is not that bad. Yeah. They just maybe might not know some dates, or they might get some dates. Obviously, they reserve first, right? Which they should, because they're on their contract. So it wasn't that bad. I don't have anything bad to say about dealing with TNA. ROH guys are usually very pleasant, and they're very accommodating too. The biggest issues, honestly, that I've ever had were with Legends. Because just being in the business for so long, I guess they are used to a certain level of catering, and sometimes that can't be provided at an indie show with 50 people, right? So,
Ross Learn, he wants to know, how has your experience been booking, well, you kind of answered that, old school wrestlers like Bushwhacker Luke, etc., compared to newer talent in the business? And he also wants to know, are there any talks about the next Iqaluit tour? And he says, MPW rocks.
Well, thank you. We don't use Legends that much. Honestly, we don't, because I personally don't feel that their fees and what they need warrant the asses that they bring into seats. Just putting it the way JR would, you know, you've got to put asses in seats, or every 17 inches or whatever it is. But to me, the guys that we have in Ontario are definitely more conducive to talent like the X Division and TNA and you know, any sort of former WWE superstars that are good at work rate and good at working. I just think that they would fit better. In terms of an Iqaluit tour, we're hoping every May. We were going to do it every year. We did two in 2008 in January and December. You came with us in May of 2011, so hopefully we'll do it every year. It seems like we will.
And, it was a lot of fun. Yeah, and we got to meet Ross at those shows, so it was cool to actually meet someone who was like, listen to us. Mike Still. Question for Arto. When I first read about the merger with Max Pro, the suggestion was you and Scott were trying for a national product with cross-Canada tours, television, and possibly internet pay-per-view. I know not to believe everything I read on the sheets, but any chance of seeing one of your shows in Saskatchewan, either live or on television? Regina's in a strange spot. It's a long way between Winnipeg and Calgary independent promotions.
We've done, in 2008, we did Yorkton, Estevan, and Swift Current in Saskatchewan. We did a cross-Canada tour, and honestly, that was just basically me with a lot of time on my hands promoting shows remotely. That's really what it was. It was just me, like, planning out a route and being like, I want to do shows across Canada. So I tried people locally, and I found, like, local people in different cities and said, hey, why don't we put on a show, do charitable things, that kind of stuff. And that's how that worked out. And now that I have less time on my hands, I don't have the opportunity to do that kind of thing. So what I do is I try and find people who are local that would want to bring Max Pro to those areas. Sure. But a lot of the times, honestly, like, I mean, for example, PWA out in Calgary, I mean, they have a good thing going because they're all local people. So yeah. In their opinion, why would they want to bring a brand like Maximum Pro Wrestling unless they're trying to save money on talent? Because we have, like, you know, Scott D'Amore is a legend in the business, so he gets, like, discounts with certain names because it's Scott D'Amore. They know that they're not going to get stiffed with Scott in the picture, and, you know, Scott can command a certain price. I fucking hate when promoters stiff talent. I agree with negotiation. Like, if I say, okay, I'm going to pay you $100 plus trans, I'm going to give you the $100. Maybe you have the right to say no. Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like Kane wrote an article about this once, right? He wrote an article about just like people getting upset about the whole independent contractor status. But you have the right to say no and you have the right to accept. What I get upset at is when promoters say they'll pay a certain amount and they don't.
Yeah.
That ruins business. And that ruins my business.
Once you made that deal, it's like you have an obligation to show up and perform what we are paying you for. And I have an obligation to pay what I've said I've paid you for.
And it has nothing to do with if you regularly get paid $500 and I offer you $350 and you accept it, I'm still expecting you to be at your 100% because you accepted it.
There's nothing that to me, like, just... It just feels so dirty when you read stories about the cliche of the indie promoter taking off with all the merch money at the halftime.
That's brutal.
At the halftime and taking off and everyone gets fucking stiff.
That's one thing I don't do. Like, for example, I don't take cuts from indie workers' merch. Like Colt, for example, we had a conversation before we went up to Calwood. He's like, well, what kind of merch should I bring? What kind of wrestling fan is it? I'm like, well, honestly, I think it's a casual fan that would remember the WWE from the 80s. So he said, okay, maybe ROH DVDs and, you know, 8x10s of me and ROH are not the greatest thing. Maybe, you know, old Scotty Goldman gimmicks or maybe some 80s WWE stuff that I have from high spots.
Yeah, he was telling us the same thing. It's like such a smart choice because you saw like other guys up there selling DVDs and stuff. And it's like, man, you're talking about 8-9-year-old kids who have like, no idea.
They won't know who Kyle O'Reilly is. They won't know who Jimmy Jacobs is.
And
even though he came
on
the tour, right?
Kane masks selling like crazy there.
There you go.
Like, that's what that crowd wanted. Steve Kassan, Arda, what do you think about the shoot style of format / mindset that the WWE is implementing? I personally see a lot of similarities to what TNA has been doing for the better part of 2 years, especially when Hogan and Bischoff came in. I'm not saying it's positive, negative, or they are copying a formula, but I'd really like your thoughts on the matter. I found this evident with what Miz and Truth said from this past Monday's Raw. Cena with his, quote, our performers are not the standard heel or face comment. This is most prevalent in TNA, where you have characters being... I lost my play. Being in basically in gray areas.
Well, I mean, the gray area term has been used for a long time, right? The Attitude Era was a perfect example of that. I think that if you look at the ratings, they would suggest, I mean, in Canada especially, we just recently had the second highest ever rated Raw on the Score, for example. So obviously something is working. And there's a lot of people that used to watch professional wrestling starting to care about professional wrestling. So it is working. I think that there is a line, and CM Punk said it best in an interview he did with Bill Simmons. He said, I know what the line is. I know how far I can go, and I know what I can't cross. I don't think we're ever going to see... I was actually surprised when Kevin Nash said, I don't have to put this guy over. I thought that was something that I would never hear. Because there are certain things like, you know, heel, baby face, you know, talking about John Laurinaitis, whatever. Like that, those are things that are still acceptable when you suspend your disbelief in pro wrestling. But I don't think we'll ever hear, you know what, I'm gonna get my shit in and I'm not gonna give you as much as you want in the comeback. Like, I don't think we're ever gonna hear that in a WWE show.
Yeah, like I always think that, you know, it's fine to do... You know, promos. To me, the initial Punk promo, the 6-minute promo, to me, it was like He talked about a lot of inside stuff, but did it in such a way that even if you didn't know the specifics, he kept it broad enough that if I was just a casual viewer watching this, I realize this guy is upset with the way this company is. He's talking about how it's gone more PG. I understand that. I can see that without having to be on the internet, the changes of the product, and none of it would have left me with the I don't understand what he's talking about. Whereas you fast forward to the Nash Punk promo last week where they're talking about the vanilla midget comment, guaranteed contracts. It's like if I was just a casual viewer who only watches Raw sparingly, I would have no idea what some of this stuff was. And I think that's what TNA does a lot, is they go way too inside, and it's crickets for 80% of the audience. Like, we are... The online audience and people listen to shows like this, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a very diehard audience that is going to seek out that information, but you can't just assume that everyone is aware of all these little details in wrestling.
Whoever asked the question, I apologize, the name, Steve made a point about TNA versus WWE and how they're treading the line. That promo that you're talking about, Kevin Nash and CM Punk, to me illustrated it perfectly, because... To me, Kevin Nash is still a little bit stuck in TNA mindset, where CM Punk, you can tell, is knows what to say and has that, you know, thought process in his mind. I don't think that Kevin Nash doesn't have it in him. I'm just saying, I think there's a little bit of TNA left there.
And I think it also, to me, Nash has always struck me as a guy who, when he goes out and he's given time to speak, he very much is a fan of trying to, like, pop the boys in the back, which is all fun and good for when you get to the back and guys are laughing and shit, but it's like, how about 5 million viewers that are watching you right now?
And you know what's funny when you say that? You're absolutely right, because that goes back to the back against the wall mentality that we were talking about earlier. It's like Ric Flair. Remember Ric Flair? He's like, there's a time when the Nature Boy didn't feel like the Nature Boy, but it took the boys to do that celebration to bring him back to making him feel like the Nature Boy again. Well, they're... constantly, like, I see this in locker rooms all the time. They're constantly seeking approval, and they're constantly seeking gratification from their peers. Yeah. And that's even more important sometimes than the fans, which is, I don't know, that's a double-edged sword sometimes.
This is the interesting psychology of the review away this week that me and Art are presenting inside the wrestler's mind. Yeah. Rick Bergman, Super Clash feedback. Number one, Pocahontas. Really? Even the 80s, that seems politically incorrect. But then again, Tatanka had quite a run. Number two, you were right, Arta, when you said you had heard the Lawler match was horrible, because it was. Still trying to decide what was worse, Von Erich not taking a bump when the King gave him a potential career-ending pile driver, or when they at the same time, for no apparent reason, decided to double punch the ref. Number three, one positive note, how the King was sporting the MMA gloves.
Was he? I didn't notice
that at all.
Chad, but I couldn't tell because the production values were so shitty. I couldn't see anything from their two-camera system.
Chad Rivera. To Arta, how did you meet Jimmy Corderas, and how did Right After Wrestling come about? How did you meet Jimmy?
I met Jimmy at one of our shows, actually. After he got released in 2008, he came to a Max Pro event. I'm not sure how he found... I think Carl DeMarco told him to find us, actually.
Carl...
I don't know if Carl was still president of WWE Canada at the time, but he had talked to Carl, and Carl said, yeah, find Max Pro or BSE, and he found us, and we just hit it off, man. We were like best buddies. It was like a bromance right at the start, and I hate to admit that, but it's exactly what it was. We're just two wrestling nerds that talked about wrestling all night, and then... Right after wrestling started, there's two versions at the time. There's the TV and the radio. They both kind of started at the same time. We got an email from the VP of television here and said, if you have any ideas for any type of shows, let me know. So I sent an email saying, what about a post-game show for wrestling? He liked it. It happened. That's really how it started. I didn't name Right After Wrestling. Greg Sansoni did. That's his name.
And, it's a really good name.
Yeah, I know. I agree. It happened Right After Wrestling. R-A-W. Perfect. And the radio show started a week after the television show. And December 2009.
There you go. Andrew G. Hickey. Hey guys, really enjoyed the Fall Brawl review. I get sick enjoyment out of horrible early to mid-90s WCW and your reviews of them, so clearly I have issues. I saw Super Clash 3 on BHS about 10 years ago. It was my first exposure to promotions outside of the Big Three at the time, and first time seeing the likes of Iceman Parsons, the other Guerrero brothers, and best of all, Buck Zumoff. I don't think was on this show. I remember being struck by the lower production values and the sleazy vibe of the women's battle royal. Sleazy was a great word to describe
that. Even though we didn't see anything.
I know. I thought the Von Erich Lawler match was great at the time. Not sure how I would feel now. I devoured any wrestling I could, but rewatching this show now might be a little painful. Luckily, we have your show. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts. Well, you've heard our thoughts. Alan Gaynor, excited to hear an AWA review. I started watching it back in 85 on WGN and then later on TSN. Incidentally, on the ESPN TSN program, they showed all of the matches from this pay-per-view in their entirety in the weeks after the show. The show is historic simply because it is the only AWA pay-per-view, but you know what it was missing? AWA talent. The card is mainly made up of Mid-South, World Class, GLOW, and CWA talent. Very few well-known AWA contracted talent outside of Colonel DeBeers and Greg Gagne. And in the case of Gagne, I think he was just receiving an allowance from his dad rather than being a contracted performer. Great job on the first show, Arda. Maybe you and Nate Milton can go the Laverne and Shirley / Mork and Mindy route and get your own spinoff. And I'm shocked that no one has asked any questions about Renee Paquette yet.
I don't know. What do you want to know? You can follow her on Twitter, at Renee Paquette. Ask her yourself.
Yeah.
Did you see the Shut Up Renee Paquette sign?
I did, right next to the Hey Arda sign. Yeah.
Who did you pay? Same guy. Yeah, who did I pay? $20, buddy. Here you go. I was handing out 20s on Twitter. Hey, get... I'll pay you $20 for a sign. Woo.
There was this week, there were two Renee Paquette signs. Did you catch that one with the handicap sign on it?
I saw it at a glance. It was like, I handicap Renee Paquette. Was he a gambler? I don't understand.
I handicap Renee Paquette.
I don't understand.
I assumed it was probably meant to be dirty, but
There's a huge discussion, actually, on the Aftermath Facebook page about it was a female that held up the Renee Paquette Shut Up sign.
Ooh.
And so there's a whole controversy about, oh, she's just jealous of Renee. And there's like a whole conversation. It's like a polarizing discussion about Renee.
Oh, my God. Amazing. So we had the two Renee Paquette signs, the Arda sign, and during the tag match, and I think in the main event, you could see a guy had a Raw is Way sign.
Nice.
Against the hard
Way is Raw. Over, man. Way is everywhere, that guy.
It's I think Lagan is still ahead of all of us for signage on
Of the Vince McMahon, the most pivotal moment of the pay-per-view, probably the last 5 years, boom, at Lagana.
Amazing.
Bam. I wonder how many followers he got from that. I'm not sure.
Oh, probably a ton, man. Probably a ton.
But before, I don't know what to tell you about Renee. Renee's great to work with. She's fun. She likes pro wrestling. She enjoys the WWE. And she is a big comedy nerd. She likes comedy a lot, for very people cool. that don't know this. So she studied at Second City. She's
really?
A big improv person.
Oh, I never
yeah.
knew that.
She did all the way to conservatory. Yeah, she's big into comedy.
We'll continue onwards here. Rob King. Mick Foley has come a long way since this appearance in his career, as he looked scared shitless here. Mike Enos makes a surprise appearance as referee in the opener. Eric Embry carried a very green Jeff Jarrett through their match. The six-person tag had TNA-like booking in it, with all the titles being on the line depending on who was pinned. I haven't seen this show in a while, and I was shocked when I looked up this card today and saw that Ivory was in the Battle Royal. And speaking of which, are we sure that Russo didn't book the women's match? Steve Cox wins dumbest nickname on the show with Do It To It. And the main event is, of course, memorable because Von Erich was about a 0.9 on the Muda scale. Okay, in terms of blood. Love Artist Choice for this show, being a real old school guy. Would love more reviews from this time frame. And the last one is Tom Ketwig. I think most people... Oh, sorry, we have a few more here. We'll quickly get through. I hit some crazy mode on my computer, so it's going to...
It's funny to watch you go. Just click single clicks to move up on your Word documents.
I put Word here on TNA mode. Tom Ketwig. I think most people know about Super Clash 3 due to the Kerry Von Erich versus Jerry Lawler match and how the match ended. I watched the Guerreros versus Rock and Roll RPMs and Cactus Jack match on Eddie Guerrero's first WWE disc and Lawler versus Von Erich on the Greatest Wrestling Stars of the 80s DVD. I enjoyed both of these matches and the rest of the card except for Eric Embry versus a young Jeff Jarrett and the Indian Strap match. We go on. The show did have the return of the Iron Sheik to national TV, even though he did not last for very long in the company. As far as I know, none of the performers got paid for the show. I give the show a 6.5 out of 10.
Which is better than our collective zero.
Yes, that's true. And finally, Michael Melkor. I love the opening of the Fall Brawl podcast. Strange as it may sound, John's lamenting leading into Artist catchphrase felt to me like the opening of an old ECW TV show. That's exactly how one of these would have started, introducing a new character. That's what you are, Art, a new character.
Nice.
From a production standpoint, very well done.
All you, by the way. That's all Mr. Pollock. So we got to put over Mr. Pollock.
Oh, yeah. It's the amazing work of fades and volume.
Ideas, baby.
As for the rest of the show, 5-star entertainment. I actually paid for this show when it first aired, and the reason for that was Arn Anderson against Ric Flair. The match and the promos leading up to them were almost worth the price of the show. Almost. Because you two did a wonderful job of pointing out how the rest of the show absolutely sucked. Can't wait to hear the Super Clash 3 show. On a parting note for Arda, the original idea for War Games was it for to be factions and went from cage matches to singles, which was the ultimate blow-off. Fans were totally into the idea of seeing Dusty and his crew get their hands on the horsemen after months of beatdowns and dirty deeds. No one minded that it would go for 20-plus minutes because they wanted the horsemen to get their final comeuppance. It was all about the action, not the ending of it. However, by the time later matches came around to the point where it was an annual match with no reason, that driving reason for the match beyond had long disappeared. But that's why fans didn't initially mind the match not having a finish until after everyone had entered the cage.
That's a very logical and great explanation. So kudos to, what was the name of the gentleman?
That was Michael Melchor.
Michael, great explanation. I like that a lot. And you know what? It speaks to the fact that we don't have that sort of, I guess, like faction hate anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, I never hated Evolution to the point where I wanted to see them get beat up before a match began for 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's something that it's, as wrestling has progressed, it's almost that you don't get that genuine hatred, you know? I mean, certain guys have... It was funny, like, JBL at his time when he was champion, I think really tried to work that side of his image, whether it be going on the internet, where people genuinely believe this guy was a real asshole in life. And it's like, we've both talked to the guy. I find him to be a super guy to with and stuff. And it's like, this guy was playing a heel, and he decided to play it outside of just being for 2 hours on television. He was going to be a heel when it was in interviews. He was going to take drastic political views that you couldn't help but disagree with. And he became a guy that you hated because you believed he was this real-life bully.
And isn't that what we want? We want somebody to suspend our disbelief. We believed he was an asshole, and it worked. Good.
I thought it was very effective. All right, this has been a 90-minute review away as we've chatted about everything from Super Clash to the Hardys to psychology to heels in today's day and age.
Has anyone stuck with us? How many people are left listening?
People love this. They love to hear us.
Okay, if you are listening to this, we gotta put a word or something that they need to put in their comments just to know if they kept with us till the end. Like put
90 minutes is AOCal. That's what I want people to write. Write that statement, okay? If you like how long this show went, I want you to hashtag or put that into your feedback. 90 minutes is AOCal.
Nice.
All right, we got to get out of here. Arda, what's coming up Monday night right after wrestling and all your other projects? Aftermath, what's going on?
Just a bunch of reviewing stuff, man. That's basically what we do. We don't have a guest for Monday yet. I'm trying to find one. You know who I'm trying to find? Haku. I want to interview Haku.
I heard you guys were looking for him.
I can't find the guy.
He was working at a used car dealership.
Is he
last
still there?
I heard.
I don't know. I'm trying. I can't just Google Haku car dealership and hope to find. Hello, it's Haku speaking.
Try Ming car dealership.
Haku's Honda. How can I help you?
Yeah, he'd be a great guy to hear from. I always like hearing from the guys that you don't typically hear
from. Yeah, that's what I love to find.
That's coming up on Monday. Go to the radio.thescore.com. That's the best place to go.
Yeah.
Twitter, he's at Arda_OCal. And what are we reviewing next week?
I have a decision to make. Help me with this. I have two choices. I was thinking The Big Event, because I actually haven't watched it from start to finish. You haven't done that yet?
No, we haven't.
Okay.
Reviewed that.
That would be cool to do, the one from Exhibition Stadium. Or I got a suggestion from a female. Believe it or not, a female fan. We have female
Bullshit.
Fans.
I don't believe
Woo!
It.
Woo! Female fans from both of ours that says Survivor Series 96. Have you done that one?
Haven't done that one either, Arda.
What do you think? Should we leave it to the listeners to decide, or should we decide right now? I would be fine with either, and I'm torn. I don't know.
You know what? I will. Monday, late Sunday night is when the show goes up. Were you planning to watch this on the weekend?
No.
Okay, so I'll put up a poll when I put up this show onto the thing, and people can pick, and we'll let it go till Monday at noon. Okay, so you'll have like 12 hours to vote, so you better be quick.
So hurry the fuck up.
So we'll either do Survivor Series 96, or we'll do the big event from Toronto. So those are your two choices, two interesting
Or we
picks.
Can redo Super Clash 3.
No, I will not vote for that. So thanks a lot to everybody. You can leave all your feedback, reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com. Follow us on Twitter, Law Radio, and all your info, liveaudiowrestling.com. Catch right after wrestling Monday night, 11:05 Eastern on Sirius 158, as Sirius goes out with a bang this week, everybody.
We miss you, Way.
Way's coming back, everyone. He's in Shanghai right now, where Twitter and Facebook have been blocked.
Oh, no, he can't even tweet.
Fuckers geo-blocked Twitter and Facebook in that country, man. Can you imagine?
Oh, man. Crazy. Well, what the hell is he doing with his life?
I don't know. Yeah, send him a...
Is he finding a wife? Is that why
that
he
might
went
be
to the homeland?
Maybe. Maybe. Maybe he's going to come back
married. That's why I refuse going to Turkey, because my parents will find me a wife.
Really?
I'm staying here. I'm AWOL.
Maybe you'll...
I'm AWOL. I'm not going back. No way. I don't want to come back married.
Send Wei your wishes at Wei... 0937, and then he'll get bombarded with messages when he returns to Canada, a country that believes people can talk freely. So there, if we didn't upset you with other stuff, I'll upset you about geo-blocking websites in 2011. All right, song. Pick a song. What do you want to go out with?
Pick a song.
With all due respect to Steve Kasson, that Stud Stable theme, there was nothing special.
What about Manny Fernandez, Bad by Michael Jackson? That's what he came out to.
Ooh, Bad by Michael Jackson. Perfect description of this pay-per-view we just reviewed.
I'm telling you, wanna go after you, wanna catch your mind.